Hey, this is Mike Evans. Listen to every episode of Schlereth and Evans on demand at 1043thefan.com. Presented by Siltahara Motors, the home of the zero down with Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. Regardless of your financial standing, no one should be without a vehicle. Visit the special financing section at sthmotors.com.
I am doing question mark, Millennial Ben.
This is a good question. Chad, I've always been interested, what kind of perspective did you learn in your coaching internship that stood out when it comes to how management feels about players? Because you were in a unique situation. You went from being a player to actually seeing what it was like on the other side when you did that, 6 week?
I've done coaching internships. I did with the Seahawks, the Jets, the Tennessee Titans, and San Francisco 49ers.
Okay, so you've done a lot of these. What were some of your biggest takeaways once you went over to the other side?
It really changed, like I said, my perspective on things. Again, as a player, you can't help but see life, you know, through your eyes, and your vision, unfortunately, is very limited about the game. And coaches don't see players as much as individuals, as much as they see them as chess pieces for my scheme. I'm looking for certain prerequisites for this particular chess piece to be able to pull off my scheme. You develop a game plan for your chess game. You know what a rook does. You know what a knight does. For Pete Carroll in Seattle, for his defensive backs, he loved long arms and length. And he would always pop his head into the defensive coach's meeting room and talk about some other player they were talking about bringing in, and he's got 37-inch arms. And all the coaches would, you know, Pete would close the door. They wouldn't necessarily laugh at Pete, but they would, you know, go, man, he just loves length. So that was, you know, he wasn't looking at a player as an individual as much as he was, here's 37-inch arms. I know what that does in my secondary, in my scheme. I can use that particular chess piece. So that kind of separate from the individual, more about attributes thinking was new for me because I played with all these different linebackers over the course of my career who were able to accomplish great things as individuals with very separate skill sets versus a coach who's just looking for, I need a guy who can do this thing because he's got 37-inch arms. So that was one fascinating thing about the process.
Did it surprise you, and I'm assuming this is what, so you, please tell me if I'm wrong, but did it surprise you how much coaches badmouth players?
It did, but my first
intern- So does that happen?
That certainly does happen. My first internship was with the Seahawks. And the super positive Pete Carroll that you see in press conferences, that's who Pete is behind the scenes. Chomping the gum, full of energy, super positive. That's who he is. That's the program that he has created there in Seattle. And it felt weird to wake up at 5:15 in the morning and be excited to go to work because that's the culture that he had created. It was fun. It was loose. There was music playing. There was all these fun things happening all the time. In the morning team meeting, there's a basketball hoop in the team meeting room, and there would be a free throw contest between guys who were college rivals or who, you know, whose teams were in the same division or conference. And so it was always something fun going on. And Pete's positivity went into the personnel evaluation department, which is always, you know, we're going to talk negative about players and how much they suck. So when we as coaches had to do our personnel evaluations, he mandated that the first thing out of your mouth be something positive about the player. We'll deal with all the things that he's terrible at after that, but find something nice to say. So this 2-hour meeting doesn't turn into a 2-hour bash session. We will find a way to say something nice about every guy, and then we'll get into his negatives. So that was how I was introduced to the whole scouting thing. Versus my other three stops, now, let's put it this, the coaches weren't always as kind in those personnel meetings. And sometimes.
How did you react when you first started hearing that? Did you just kind of sit there like, wow? Or did you speak up and say, really? This happens? This is what you guys have been doing my whole career? Is bad-mouthing me?
Chris Richard, who was the Seahawks defensive coordinator at the time, was my teammate when I played with the Seahawks. So after that first personnel meeting, I pulled Chris aside. And I was like, I had no idea. I had no idea. You guys just upstairs just dog cussed us, you know, and said how much we sucked. He's like, yeah, I was shocked as well. Now, fast forward a couple years to my time with the New York Jets. Kevin Green, his rest in peace, his dad gets sick. So Kevin has gone away from camp for 10 days. So I take over the outside linebacker room. I'm the coach. And now I've got to give personal evaluations myself.
Right.
All the scouts, all the coaches, the GM, they're all in the room. So I've got to talk about my 7 outside linebackers. So all morning, I come in an hour early, I type up my personnel reports, and I've got to give the personnel reports in the room myself. So I was thinking, you know, who am I going to be in this moment? Does the former player in me want to defend my guys? Am I a coach who's just harsh and just, you know, no quarter given? I decided to go the Pete Carroll route. Let me find something nice to say about all these guys, and then I will give my true personal evaluation. I wanted to be honest in the moment, but also I wanted to have a sense of humanity to it all. So that's I tried to toe the line in between that. And I remember I worked with the defensive line group in Seattle, and we had a player who was not very good. So when the defensive line coach gave his evaluation, he couldn't find anything positive to say about the kid as a player. But he said, oh, you know, coach, talking to Pete Carroll, if I had a daughter, I would want this guy to marry my daughter. But as a player, he sucks. So that was the one positive thing he could say. This kid's he's a great kid. He can marry my daughter, but he can't play football at all. So I tried to channel that coach and try to find something nice to say about everybody.
You were talking about Pete Carroll, and I think Pete Carroll is a fascinating example, exhibit A, if you will, of really why coaches probably aren't successful their first time around and why they need to get that second opportunity, maybe third opportunity, and really feel like, okay, if I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it right, I have to do it my way. Because you look at Pete Carroll. You know, he had 4 years as a head coach, 3 years in New England, 1 year with the Jets. He was 27 and 21, inheriting Bill Parcells' team in New England. He was 6-10 in New York. And I'm sure that the Pete Carroll that you experienced in Seattle was completely different from the Pete Carroll that coached in New England and with the Jets in terms of being able to really be his own guy and implement his own program. And let's face it, he had to go to USC, where he was given what all coaches get. It's your kingdom. You do what you want to do. And he took that and then was able to implement and demand it when he got the job in Seattle, to the point where he stood to you as an outlier from all the other places you've been. And you realize that these coaches, maybe there is something to the idea that these coaches have to go somewhere first, fail, and understand how the game works and realize if I'm going to break above the game, I got to be able to do things my way.
One of the last conversations I had with Pete before I left is he and I sat down in his office and he explained to me, Chad, whether you're a position coach, a head coach, you need to figure out what kind of coach you want to be. And I was like, well, I kind of want to be a little bit of Bill Cowher. I kind of want to be a little bit of Bill Belichick. I want to take some of these things from these guys who, you know, I thought were great. You know, Bill Cowher with the emotion of the game and the chin and understanding how players play better when they're passionate. And I like the analytic side of Bill Belichick and trying to put players in positions to execute the right play for each circumstance. And he's like, no, I'm talking about culture. I'm talking about personality. It's more than just, let me steal these things from these guys. You need to figure out who you are inside as a coach. And that's when I realized, oh, so this whole positivity thing, that's your entire program. That's you as a person creating a culture that influences everybody within the organization, with this one thing you think is so critically important. And now you've taken that one thing and made an entire organizational plan based on that. Even the personnel meetings have to have some positivity to it, some belief about how things can happen. So that ability for Seahawks to win games in the fourth quarter isn't because Russell Wilson is great. That certainly helps. But it's that entire culture that Pete developed and honed at USC brought to Seattle that he didn't have in New England. He hadn't figured that out with the Jets. He figured it out and put that into the culture there. Bill Belichick, I think, was a tremendous coach with the Cleveland Browns, but not nearly as able to execute the entire system that he has in New England now.
So you, having had a chance to go and experience all these different franchises and ways of doing business, knowing what you learned, and I'm asking you a difficult question because you weren't there, but, hey, you got more insight than most people do. Explain then how it worked around here for the last 5 years with a John Elway run organization.
That's tricky. I mean, it was tricky. You know, obviously I know Vance Joseph really well, and I know some of the coaches who were on Vance's staff really well. High school teammates of mine. So, you know, there were some decisions that came from upstairs that were not received well down in the coach's office. Personnel decisions, who gets to play every week decisions. And so how is Vance going to be able to implement his culture, his plan, when in some circumstances you don't even get to say who plays on Sunday? That's tricky. That's incredibly tricky to pull off. So for these coaches who are desperate for that coaching job, and I think to your point, yeah, sometimes you need to get that first job and get it out of the way so you can know what you need to demand for job two. When you earn that second opportunity, you also are coming in with a list of demands that you don't want to repeat from your first go-around. There was a meddling owner for Bill Belichick in Cleveland with Art Modell versus Mr. Kraft in New England, who's certainly involved, but I don't think anyone would call him meddling. So you have a partner as an owner versus an owner who's moving the franchise without telling you and trying to influence draft selections. Bill is much more successful in New England because he's able to implement his system versus what he was
so
able to do in Cleveland.
So does the traditional, I'm the GM, you're the coach, is that a model that is past its expiration date in NFL?
I think Snyder and Carroll in Seattle have a great partnership. Fantastic.
But who's ultimately in charge? Push comes to shove. You know, we are debating Chad Brown and whether or not he's going to be on this team. John Schneider wants him on the team. Pete Carroll doesn't.
I think they have a conversation until they agree or agree upon their disagreement. I've had many conversations with Scott Pioli, former general manager of the New England Patriots. He said, Bill and I don't do anything until we agree. Doesn't mean that we always are on exactly the same page, but one of us will give in with an agreement, even if we disagree. I know it's kind of parsing words there, but I think that situation is much better than...
But that's still a partnership, right?
Walking out of the head coach, walking out of the GM's office with a mandate that he just can't accept, but has to accept. That undermines the head coach's authority. That undermines the program he's trying to implement. Who's running the ship? Whose program are we doing? What's the culture here? Am I responsible for the culture, but you get to tell me what to do? How does that work out? How can I possibly be successful implementing this culture? Because you made me sit down for 8 hours when you hired me and tell you all these things I'm going to do, and then you decide, nope, I want you to do this, and I want you to do that. Then why did we do that whole song and dance for 8 hours and I had to list out all the things I was going to do as a head coach? Why didn't you just tell me, skip that part?
So if you're telling me that you know that there were times that Vance Joseph and his staff was like, okay, we gotta do what the front office is telling us to do, what John is telling us to do. I gotta believe that the same thing occurred with Vic Fangio. So then here's George Payton. Let's bring it to the here and now. Right, George Payton did not hire Vic Fangio. Everything you're describing, everything I'm hearing tells me that it is going to be a monumental task to think that George Payton and Vic Fangio are going to coexist, that partnership that you're talking about, in a way that's going to be successful. It just feels like it's inevitable that Vic is not the guy.
I'm not sure how you went there. The George Payton we've seen in press conferences, the George Payton we've seen in every public event that he has had, he comes across as a guy who's reasonable, who's willing to listen, whether it's his scouts or his coach, and seems to want to find some kind of consensus. He doesn't seem to be my way or the highway kind of guy. We talked about ego in coaching rooms and front offices earlier in the show, but George Payton doesn't strike me as an ego guy. I think we clearly can recognize John Elway has an ego, which is not the worst thing in the world. Michael Jordan, as we saw in The Last Dance, has an ego. Aaron Rodgers, his ego is playing out publicly over the last week and a half. So that's not a terrible thing to have. But I think as a GM, in order to give your coach best chance for success, if this is the guy you hired, then give him best chance for success and let him try to implement his plan for the culture, for the scheme, for all the things he's trying to build. And when you get in there and meddle, that has a ripple effect far beyond that specific thing and undermines that coach, maybe to his staff, maybe to the players, maybe the culture he's trying to build. If we as a staff agree these are the starting guys for this particular game, and suddenly the head coach has to come in and tell the staff that we're going to go with somebody different, and he says it in that way, you know that's not his decision. That's coming from someplace else. Now that head coach has been undermined directly to his staff.
See, I just don't know if the vision of your franchise, the culture of your franchise, can be created and established by your GM. The way you describe it to me is it has to come from the coach who best understands what he's trying to do every week, the kind of players he wants, and he has to, whether it's in a partnership with the GM he works with, or if it's just simply, I'm the boss and you're the GM and you're working for me, it seems to me that if you look at the most successful franchises, there is more of an element of that being the model as opposed to, okay, I'm the GM and I am setting the course for this franchise.
Then you've got two separate courses because the head coach and the GM obviously are going to have separate visions in mind. I think there absolutely has to be a partnership.
But do you get what I'm saying? The idea that George Payton and Vic Fangio instantly have formed that kind of partnership that you're saying is so important, isn't that really kind of asking a lot? Wouldn't the odds of that occurring be pretty remote?
It would be pretty remote, but I think if you spend some time together, let's find the things that we agree upon and then try to implement those. And these 10 things that we agree upon, great. And if there's two or three things that we disagree upon, let's keep talking it out until we can find a way we can meet somewhere in the middle so we can be on the same page. Because once those guys get on separate pages, I've seen that as a player and I've seen that as an intern coach. It doesn't end well. And it doesn't end well for all of them, and they all end up fired. So your ego got your butt canned. How do you feel now about your plan? How do you feel now about not being willing to bend to each other where you guys could work it out? Now you guys are both at home on your couch. How'd that work for you?
Does it, all the chances you got to work and see the other side, did it amaze you, surprise you, disappoint you, shock you? How poorly run a lot of these franchises and front offices are. I mean, you're only talking about 32 of them in the entire world. You would think the best of the best are working here, right? Did it shock you at how, wow, this isn't what I expected?
I will say this, no matter what higher up opportunity I have gotten in life to see the inner workings, professional football, broadcasting, certain business things, you know, all that I've done. As I've gotten higher up, you as a kid, as a naive person, as a regular employee, you think everyone up top's got it all figured out.
Yeah.
They're all working together, and egos aren't a part of it.
Yeah.
And we're all just marching in the same direction to all be successful. And once you get a glimpse, and once the curtain is pulled back, there is no wizard.
No.
It's amazing how much, it's amazing how things actually even get done with as much chaos as there is at the top of football organizations, in broadcasting, in business, with the screw-ups and the people who shouldn't be in certain positions who are there due to family connections or whatever else they have. And it's not always about success and putting the best product together.
I guarantee you there are people listening right now who are at their own jobs or going to their own jobs and are like, oh, yeah, you think you should see my place.
Absolutely.
I can't believe it. And I get that. But you would think at this level, only the best of the best.
But football was the ultimate winning business.
Right.
And all decisions were made about winning.
Right.
And that is simply not
so
the case.
So when Schlereth says there are maybe 8 to 10 teams in the NFL that are truly consumed with winning, where winning is what matters most. He says there are only 8 to 10. Would you agree with that?
I'm going to kick that down to 6 to 8.
Wow.
Where ego doesn't take precedent, where hiring decisions aren't made for family decisions or previous relationships, but hiring the best people? No, it is all those other things become a factor for those other 25 teams that take the focus away from winning onto other important things.
So 1 in 5, 20% of NFL teams
are focused on winning.
That's it.
With every decision that they make, the other ones are making decisions for all other kind of reasons.
And the Broncos right now are?
I think they're trying to get back to that place. But they have not been in that place.
Okay. All right. Great conversation. All right. Get your thoughts on it. RamosLaw.com text line 303-713-1043. We'll also hear from John Clayton. Man, this guy was on top of everything with the Broncos offseason. Where does he see the Aaron Rodgers situation finishing? Does it finish here? We'll talk to John Clayton next.
Hey, it's Mike Evans. Siltahar Motors is the home of zero down. Regardless of your credit or financial situation, Siltahar Motors will help you get behind the wheel. People with poor credit or in bankruptcy can qualify for zero down and no payments for 45 days and be driving in their new car within hours of stopping by the dealership. Check out any of the cars Siltahar Motors currently has on site at sthmotors.com. Siltahar Motors is conveniently located at Highway 36 in Wadsworth, so regardless of your financial situation, Siltahar Motors will get you the car you deserve at sthmotors.com.
We are joined now by 104.3 The Fan senior Broncos writer from DenverFan.com, John Clayton, presented by Flesh and Beck Law, injury attorneys. John, good morning.
Good morning.
Before we go any further, I got a ton of football stuff. I just want to know what yours and Chad Brown's relationship was like those days in Seattle.
It was good.
What do you remember about it? Both of you. What do you remember? Reminisce a little bit.
Well, I mean, it was good because, again, it's like, obviously I had a great relationship with his agent. He was always great to talk to because he was so intelligent, able to give you good information. I thought I had a great relationship. I don't know how he feels, but it's like, I think it was great.
Well, thanks, John, for the kind words. My first memory of you, John, is doing one of your stand-ups right there at the Seahawks practice field.
Uh-huh.
And you got a coat and tie on up top, and you got shorts and flip-flops on down below. So that was my first glimpse behind the scenes at broadcasting, realizing it's all not as real as we think it is sitting at home watching on TV.
Yeah, because, again, it's like even the same thing when I was doing, because obviously I've had the studio here for the long period of time. It's like, you just wear, just flip-flops or whatever, but you know, all you had to do is make sure that you're good enough for the camera to be able to you know, see how that was going to take you in, and then anything else was irrelevant. I still remember, you'll appreciate this because of, this was Kevin Mawai, and he came over to me on a game when he was in Tennessee, and walked over and he says, "Hey, so," and I just done my, you know, right spot before sport, before on Sunday morning, because I always do like about 10:55. And he says, "Hey, so when you're at home, what do you do as far as, you know, the clothes below the sport coat and all that stuff?" I said, "Well, I wear nothing." And he says, "You can't tell me that. I got a game to think about. I'm going to think about this the entire game." And obviously it's not true, but it's, I just thought I threw him off a little bit.
All right, John, let's get to the football stuff. How do you see this Aaron Rodgers situation ending?
He's not going to show up. There's no way. Because go back in history, and, of course, the history is that, you know, in 2011, you know, Carson Palmer had been 7 years with the Bengals. He'd only been to two playoffs. He's coming off a 4-12 season, and he was sick of them not having the ability to go ahead and, you know, get players for him. And so he held out into October saying he was going to retire. And he even said boldly, it's like, "I've got $80 million in the bank. I don't have to show up." And so he didn't show up. They ended up trading him to the Raiders for a first and a conditional second that could have gone to a first but didn't. And so I can see the same thing happening with Aaron Rodgers. And one of the reasons is his agent is David Dunn, Aaron Rodgers' agent. That was Carson Palmer's agent. So they already know the things to do. And you can see almost every day Carson Palmer, not Carson Palmer, but Aaron Rodgers has done something to betray the Packers. I mean, telling free agents not to, he's not going to be there. Telling guys who are trying to resign, he's not going to be there. He's not going to be there. So at some point, the Packers have to recognize it. And the only two teams I can see in the bidding to try to do something would be the Denver Broncos and the Washington football team. And so those are the only two teams, because every other team has made their quarterback move. I don't see anything happening maybe until late August or maybe sometime in September or October. But at some point, they've got to recognize it and realize he's not going to be there.
Okay, so Aaron's not going to be there. We got two possible landing spots where he goes. What kind of draft picks and current player options are going to have to happen for the Packers to give up Aaron Rodgers and make this deal a done deal?
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to go, particularly under the circumstance, because of the fact it's a big contract that's being moved at a time that the cap's down 8% to 182.5. You know, so you would think, I mean, you know, a 1 and a 2 would be the price, but it might be a little bit less because, again, there's just not a big enough market with the number of teams that are going to be bidding, so it could be less than that. And so can you imagine being able to pick up Aaron Rodgers for, let's say, a second-round pick and maybe a first-round pick next year? I mean, that could be a possibility. So, but, you know, I think it's one. And that's why if you're Denver, you had to have this in the back of your mind when you're thinking about what to do, you know, whether to take Justin Fields or take somebody else. And that's something that's like, well, you know what? We might be able to get Aaron Rodgers. So you have Teddy Bridgewater. You make that trade. Only have to give up a sixth-round pick and pay him $4.7 million on a one-year deal. You have Drew Locke, but then you can get Aaron Rodgers and then do a contract extension with him.
But could you see the Raiders being very interested in Aaron Rodgers as well? And if you've got the Raiders and the Broncos both interested in Aaron Rodgers in a division with Justin Herbert and you know who, then doesn't this then become a bidding war and the price maybe becomes extravagant?
Well, the Raiders could get involved, but they don't have the cap room to be able to do this. I mean, look what they had to do. They had to trade three starting offensive linemen, and then they come back and they take Colton Miller and they give him $18 million a year. I mean, they're cap-strapped. And they basically, if you look at the way that they handle their stuff and personnel, I mean, there's no plan. I mean, everything is kind of like, oh, well, what do we do today? What do we do today? And, you know, that's why, for example, you know, they go in, and you see there's going to probably be some firings in the front office. I don't know who, but they had problems. Then they go in and take Alex Leatherwood with the first round pick at 17. not trading back because he was a low first round, high second round pick. I mean, they take him with the 17th pick. I don't think anybody had a first round grade on him. And so they take him at a position that's pretty close to where the first round grades are. And so there's no plan there right now. I mean, how about the idea with the Raiders that, you know, here they have one of the best young running backs in the league. And they end up paying 2 years, $11 million for Stephon Drake to be a backup running back. And they're cap strapped. It's not good.
Oh, Raiders are going to do what Raiders do, apparently. Let's move on to the Juwan James issue. I mean, at this point here locally, the Bronco fans want to get some retribution for Juwan James stealing money over the years. I see this much more from a player protection standpoint between the union and the NFL itself. How do you think this whole thing plays out?
He gets cut. I mean, he gets cut with a NFI, non-football injury, because, I mean, here he is making, what, $12.25 million a year. He sat out last year. He had a $5 million base the first year, and then he got $15 million signing bonus, but or $12 million signing bonus on his four-year deal. But you look at it, and then now you have to have that little warning going around the league because the NFLPA wants all the players to boycott. And I don't know if he was boycotting or what he was doing because, you know, he wasn't there at the facility. But the fact that, you know, he comes back and gets the Achilles tear, now it's like, you know, you wonder. They had the faith in him to be able to, you know, keep him on the roster at $12.25 million, and now, you know, he misses last year with the opt-out, then he blows out the Achilles tendon, so you know he's not going to be there, and I don't know if Dennis Kelly's going to be the option or Charles Leno's going to be the option to come in to replace him, but it's like, you know, he's done. But also, if you look around, it's like, okay, so you want to boycott, look what happens. I mean, he's going to lose $32 million because he has $10 million base this year, he has $11 million the next 2 years, and so now he's going to lose all of that. And so I think that, you know, he put himself in a position by not being at the facility and not being there for the off-season workouts that now he's going to lose $32 million.
So you expect the Broncos to really go after him hard and put the screws to him?
What choice do they have?
Okay. Because what I was going to say is we've been discussing this. Do the Broncos want to set a precedent here in which now other teams might follow the same course? And do you, as a ownership group, do you want, you've got the players on the run, you've got them under your thumb, do you want to do something that could potentially galvanize what is the weakest union in all of professional sports?
Well, I mean, what you look at is like, it's not anything that's vindictive against him. It's just a business decision because, you know, here he was, you know, because remember, he's only played 1 year, you know, on a 4 year deal because he opted out. I mean, he got the $150,000 for, you know, being on an opt out. But, still, it's like, you know, and you look around the league, particularly at the 12, with all the stuff that's going on with $10 million contracts, there's been so many $10 million contracts, particularly on the offensive line. And so I would have to think that, you know, it's not vindictive. They're not trying to make a statement. It's just reality. It's like, okay, so you come back, you, blow out your Achilles. You're not at the facility. So it's like, now we have to replace you. I don't know what the cost of replacement is going to be. It's probably not going to be too much because of the way the market is right now. But I have to think that right now he's going to be a former Bronco, not a current Bronco.
All right. Great stuff. John, as always, appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
That was 104.3 The Fan's senior Broncos writer, John Clayton, presented by Flesh and Beck Law. Injury attorneys, read John's latest on the Broncos every day at DenverFan.com. Thank you to John. Right now, going to give you a chance to win MLB The Show 21. It's out now on both PlayStation and Xbox consoles. It's fun for hardcore casual baseball fans. You can play all 162 games or just drop in for the biggest moments of the postseason. Create your own dream team in Diamond Dynasty with your favorite legends and current stars. We're giving away a free copy for PlayStation or Xbox. All you have to do to enter to register to win, just sign up for the free Denver Sports Daily, our daily newsletter with news, columns, game recaps, and more. Sign up now at DenverFan.com. You want to have it anyway. Added incentive, sign up. You get a chance to win MLB The Show 21. One of Chad's comments to John Clayton did not get received well by a certain group of fans. We'll tell you who they are next.
I love the fact that we have people listening all over the place, all over the country, all over the world. This one comes in from Jackie C. in Vancouver, Washington. Not Vancouver, British Columbia. Apparently there's a Vancouver, Washington. Anyway, here's the question. Would Paxton Lynch get paid if he was away from the facility playing Madden and got carpal tunnel syndrome? First of all, it's a smear. It's a topical smear. It works with the conversation. So it's day number 2194 of the Paxton Lynch smear campaign. But that actually has happened. David Price, who's now with the Dodgers,
yes,
had to miss time pitching because he did have carpal tunnel syndrome, sprained wrist.
Like Fortnite, right?
Playing Fortnite.
I saw a list of, you know, crazy reasons why players have missed time.
Right.
And that is on the list. Infected finger or toes from pedicures or manicures. Yeah. Some kind of fishing hook injury.
Sprained eyelash. Seriously. Baseball player missed time because of a sprained, twisted eyelash.
I would have to make the training staff come up with something better than that.
Right. And then, of course, there is heavy legs.
Yes.
Let's not forget about heavy legs. Can you imagine a football player? Even Juwan James wouldn't sit out a game with heavy legs. But there's the difference between, so David Price, guaranteed contract, baseball, strongest union there is in all the sports. Good luck trying to go after his money.
Right.
You'd have every right to.
Strong union.
Right?
Union wouldn't allow it to happen.
Would never happen.
Yeah.
Teams didn't even pursue it. Man. Which is why I just, you know, you got plenty of people who are like, you know, John Clayton just schooled you. The Broncos are going to get every penny back from Juwan James, and they'll be justified. Maybe they will. And you know what? I'll be pleasantly surprised if they do, because guys like Juwan James should not be rewarded. But I just look at the bigger picture, and I just wonder whether an NFL group of owners who have so much power, why would they want to give – any incentive, any cause for the players to rally together when this is a group of players who constantly shoot themselves in the foot, never can get unified, never can show any solidarity. Why in the world would you give them even a crumb of possibility to rally around a cause?
Yeah.
Why would you do it?
I think the owners are fine to lose the series, but win the game.
Right.
You know, yes, sure. We get a punt. Fine. We'll pay him the money, but we still win the game.
Yeah.
By keeping you guys upset at your union, not allowing you guys to come together and do something else and try to, you know, amend the CBA or whatever the case may be. It's a far lesser cost from a business standpoint.
Now, there is one other way of looking at it, though. There is the other way of looking at it. It could be as simple as this. Hey, we know that this union lacks any continuity, any kind of solidarity. Let's actually really hammer one of these players for getting hurt away from the facility, and that'll put an end to any of these guys having any thought of staying away. They'll all come back in droves. Yeah, there'll be some guys who will say, no, we got to fight the good fight. But they'll get overrun by the guys who are like, look what happened to Juwan James. That's not going to happen to me. And they come running back. This is even maybe a way for the owners to further crush, maybe crush forever the players' union.
Wow.
What about that scenario?
That's a strong thought. I've spent time with professional basketball players and professional basketball coaches. I've spent time with Major League Baseball players. Not much time with hockey guys, but of all the sport guys I've ever been around, the NFL players are definitely the guys who are the most afraid for their jobs on a constant basis, or even just the perception that whatever they're doing may give the team or the owner. So they're always afraid of that. And I think the NFL knows NFL players operate with that mindset. To have a conversation with baseball player or basketball players in particular, that is the most confident dudes, guaranteed salaries, yep. Everything's easy. Our players run the union. We got this whole thing figured out. NFL players do not give off that vibe at all, ever. We're always afraid. They're always going to draft somebody to replace me. The guy's going to give me, if I make $4 million, he makes $400,000. That's 10 times less. The team has got incentive to keep him over me, even if I'm a better player. The union is so weak right now. Could the owners possibly crush them here? They could, but there also would be the risk of somehow the players' union coming together, becoming united, and fighting back very much like, I don't know, some kind of Star Wars moment or something.
Right. The rebellion.
Yes.
Get Raj in here.
And Nick.
And Nick
Cecil.
And Cecil. And they can find all
the
parallels.
We just didn't have May the 4th. So
right.
The 4th
we can
be with
find
you.
All the parallels between the rebellion and the Death Star.
Which is.
The evil empire.
I have been to the NFL offices, and it does feel like an evil empire.
Really? You've been there?
I've been there.
When you walk in there, you feel like you're...
Yeah.
You've been beamed up to the Death Star, huh?
I was in the lunchroom, and Roger Goodell was there. And when he walked in, it was so odd because, you know, these are all NFL employees.
Uh-huh.
He walked in, and suddenly the room just got a little bit quieter. And I was like, oh my gosh, you guys are... Even you guys are afraid of this dude. It's
like
so weird.
Like play the music. Play the Imperial March, right?
Right.
Here he comes, Goodell. Boy, does Goodell have a great gig.
Oh, man. $40 million a year.
Just take all the slings and arrows and just be the front man, be the shield for the owners and get paid $40
million. Yeah, good for him, man.
Never forget, Roger Goodell doesn't do anything without the owners telling him first.
He works for the owners.
He works for the owners.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets paid $40 million to do it.
Good for him.
Man, that's good. All right. Boy, people just do not like Juwan James. Wow.
Well, you know, and to defend those people, he hasn't made himself very likable.
I know.
So I understand where they are coming from. Absolutely.
Wow, I can't believe you guys are such Juwan James fans. Why don't you start a GoFundMe page for him? Jeez.
I like you a lot.
All right. I get it.
Yes.
I get it. Bronco fans, you want your pound of flesh. I don't blame you. But all I'm saying is at least take the bigger picture into play here. That's all I'm asking. Hey, Chad, I really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for sitting in these last 3 days. It was great. It's not easy getting up early in the morning, day after day. You did a great job. I loved it. Thank you, my friend.
This is fantastic, man. You are an absolute pro at what you do. I've had the pleasure of working with everybody here at The Fan. Everyone's a pro, but you have a way of drawing out the best in everybody.
Oh, well,
good job by you, man.
That. Thank you. All right, Mark is back tomorrow. We'll see what kind of fresh Aaron Rodgers stories he's going to break.
Have fun with that.
Oh, he's got to be wondering, why did I do that? Ah, okay, he's back tomorrow. Sandy in Orlando coming up next.
Hey, it's Mike Evans. Siltahar Motors understands sometimes bad things happen to good people. That includes bankruptcy. If that is you, you can still purchase a car at Siltahar with zero money down in almost all cases. This is a program they've been doing for 25 years. The dealership itself is almost 60. Family-owned business that is proud of their reputation and proud to be a huge part of the Broomfield community. If you file bankruptcy, Siltahar Motors can help. Zero down and no payments for 45 days in almost all cases. Contact Team Zero Down at 720-446-9222 or online at sthmotors.com.